God opened my eyes in a pretty miraculous way to see both the fact that he was moving here and that the needs were great. And that if we joined him in his work here, it wouldn't be starting something fresh. It would just be stepping into the move of the Spirit that was already happening.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We're recording this episode on Wednesday, June 17th, 2026. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, is still on vacation and recovering from his daughter's wedding this past weekend. J.D. and I are, however, joined by the Reverend Derek Roberts. Derek, welcome to Stand Firm.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You are rector of Hope Church in Charleston, West Virginia. J.D. and I wanted to have you on the show today basically just to tell your story as an encouragement to our listener. You've been involved in church planting in really tough Appalachian areas and been successful, such that your church plant has seeded several other church plants in the region, and your ministry is a blessing to so many. So tell us about yourself, how you were called into the work you're doing, all the way up until some really amazing blessings just in the last few months. I'm sure we'll stop and ask questions along the way. Where does your story begin?
So I grew up the grandson of a fundamentalist Baptist pastor, which obviously leads straight to becoming an Anglican clergyman.
King James only?
King James only, yeah. No dancing, no drinking, no fun.
That's right.
Yep, the whole deal.
That's right.
And so kind of pretty early on in life, walked away from the faith. Mm-hmm. Kind of consciously chose to move away from what I'd experienced growing up. And it wasn't until, I think, junior year of undergrad when it was invited to a Bible study, of all things. Mm-hmm. And I had pretty successfully avoided saying yes and actually going to the Bible study for a long time. But one evening in particular, I had nothing going on and couldn't come up with an excuse and decided to relent and go. And I think it was even the very first week, it became like clear to me that I did not know anything about the Bible, like actually mm-hmm. about the Bible. Had all these stories from Sunday school growing up on the flannel graph floating around in my head, and had a strong sense that I knew everything, but being confronted with the actual Word of God, I was like, I don't know anything. I feel like I wasn't taught any of this stuff. I know that's not true, but it really did feel that way. And so launched into reading the Bible and read most of it within that first year, and highlighted everything in the Bible that I felt like I'd never heard before. And it was just a mess of ink
of highlights.
Yeah. Mm. And so started getting involved in ministry even pretty quickly after that, started helping to lead the Bible study that I was going to, then got into youth ministry and worked with Young Life for a season, and then worked in the church, in a non-denominational church for a season, and just felt my heart kind of drifting away from students and toward adults. And so I really didn't know what to do with that or how to approach it. So decided seminary might be a good choice. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Denver Seminary, and kind of in that transition, my wife and I both, we got married between first ministry job and seminary. And we both kind of were feeling drawn to something a little more historically rooted. Liturgy seemed attractive, but we had not really experienced it, so we didn't really know what we were looking for. So we moved to Colorado, and we had a fresh chance to look around and figure out what we wanted to be. And so we sort of by happenstance ended up in an Anglican church there. And so we were kind of hearing all these adjectives tossed around about what this church was like. It was reformed and charismatic and liturgical and all these things. And we're like, well, that's weird, but it could be cool. And so we decided to check it out. And I think from the first downbeat of the first song, we were like completely bought in. And so we never left. And so we ended up being a part of a church plant out of that church. And then about 2 years into that plant, we we're really sensing that God was calling us to plant a church. And the church we were a part of out there had a pretty strong initiative toward church planting in the kind of old suburbs around downtown Denver. Like, a lot of churches have been planted in the inner city, downtown area. Lots of churches were planted in the suburbs, but not much was going on in the sort of working class suburbs in the ring around downtown. And so we thought that that was what we would do. And so we prayed and spent some time kind of discerning whether or not it was one of those places was where we were supposed to go, and just kind of met desolation upon desolation. Just no sense that God was drawing us to any of those places. And so we had trips planned over the coming months. And so we said, maybe we should just do this everywhere we go. And so we went we had trips planned to Charleston, West Virginia for a wedding. We were going to Fort Worth, Texas, and to the Gulf Coast of Florida. And Texas and Florida sounded great, but I didn't really have any desire to come back to West Virginia.
Sort of,
but like we came back to West Virginia.
Closed yourself off to that, right? Like you were leaving West Virginia behind on purpose. Right?
West Virginia was gone, yeah, to me.
And I never had any avoided. You specifically avoided country roads then, because obviously that would have no doubt led you back there. So
yeah, no doubt, right?
Oh, so witty.
Yeah.
Did you have any initial interest, or did you in Fort Worth or the Gulf Coast? I mean, obviously interest in the places, but like, were there conversations that began, or was that just a clear no?
Yeah, I hadn't even made it that far. The first trip that we took was to West Virginia. And so it was January of 2017, and made it a whole week without praying. My wife and I both have family in West Virginia, so we spent time with family and avoided spending any time trying to discern if that's where God was calling us. Maybe that may be the first red flag that maybe that was where He was taking us. But made it to right before the wedding. We, like, between pictures and the actual ceremony, and spent some time praying, and really felt like God opened my eyes in a pretty miraculous way to see both the fact that He was moving here and that the needs were great, and that if we joined Him in His work here, it wouldn't be starting something fresh. It would just be stepping into the move of the Spirit that was already happening. And so I'm wrecked emotionally, like, have no concept of how to process that in those moments. But make it through the wedding, give my horrible best man speech. I was still crying hard enough that I couldn't see my notes on my phone for my speech. So I just freestyled it, and it was bad. Hopefully there's no evidence of that speech anywhere. But the interesting things started happening from that point forward. So I run into a guy after the wedding, and we had had a conversation about kind of our Anglican journey a few years before this. And I run into him at the reception of the wedding, and he says, "Hey man, I hope you haven't forgot that conversation we had 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm definitely still interested in being a part of something like that if you ever decide to come back and do it." And so to him in that moment, I said, I don't know. I think maybe God is calling us back here to plant a church. And I think the earliest we could do something would be January of 2018. And this is January 2017. And that's, I wasn't even ordained a deacon. And that all of that is literally impossible. And so, but those words come out of my mouth, and I kind of walk away and go back to Colorado. I sit for my ordination exams on the Monday after we get back. And so I get done with the first day of exams, spend 8 hours writing Bible essays, and sit down with my rector out there. And he kind of gets serious at one point in the conversation and kind of leans forward and says, "Hey man, do you feel like you have any clarity on the future?" I'm like, "What do you mean? Like, what are you talking about?" Well, I had this like pretty profound experience praying in West Virginia. I think maybe God is calling us back to Charleston. And so I'm like, "Well, gosh, that's affirming." So he said that he really felt like the Spirit spoke to him when he picked me up from the airport and said, like, "Get ready. They're getting ready to move back to West Virginia." And so we're like, "Okay, all right, maybe this is what God's doing." So he says, "Reach out to my friend who's a bishop who has churches in West Virginia." And that was Bishop Steve Breedlove. So I emailed him, I think the following Wednesday, and he emails me back like within 5 minutes, which I was not accustomed to having that response from bishops. I'd never gotten that before. 10 weeks.
And you don't maybe. Always get it since.
No, I haven't, not once since, I don't think. But he just said, hey, I would probably be normally inclined to ignore your email, but it just so happens that my wife and I were in West Virginia this past weekend praying for a church planter to reach out to us saying they wanted to plant a church in West Virginia. And we were laughing at how ridiculous that prayer was. Mm. Like, no one's ever done that before and it's not going to happen in the future. But you emailing me a couple of days after that, you got my attention. So let's like keep the conversation up. Mm. And so we took that as affirmation. We put our house on the market, sold our house, and we're in West Virginia by May of 2017. So we started meeting in our living room with six people in July, and grew out of our living room in the coming months, and moved into a bigger living room, then had a few preview services, and then we, in January of 2018, launched weekly services. Mm.
So what diocese, I guess you were in Rocky Mountain before then, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. Yeah, so I was ordained a deacon there, moved as a deacon, and was ordained a priest the week before we started weekly services.
And y'all were at Denver Seminary?
Yes, yep.
Yeah. Was Bruce Demarest still there? Is he alive still?
I don't know. He was not there when I was there. His name's all over everything. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I don't know. But, yeah, that's my... No. So the transition back into West Virginia, I mean, were you met with fanfare and applause and, what did that look like? And I mean, just if there's, our listener might be thinking of planting a church in his hometown or somewhere near. So I don't know what he could expect would be normative in your experience.
Yeah, I would not say it was fanfare. I mean, we did meet with a lot of people and mostly out of curiosity, like, do you think this is a crazy idea was sort of the question I was asking, not like jump on board and get involved, but like, is this dumb? And I think that question was almost universally, it's a great idea, you should definitely do it. And right. Then came the conversations asking for people to be involved, but.
Now, were you met with suspicion from your, at least acquaintances who may have still have been in the Fundamentalist Baptist Church, or was there, or has that been a fruitful mission field? Or,
yeah, I mean, I think we probably have in our church even now, I mean, probably only a handful of people who had any experience with liturgical traditions prior to coming here. And so, yeah, I think that has been, I mean, that's predominant in West Virginia, period. So sure. It's hard to find Christians who haven't spent time in something along those lines, traditions.
And so how long you've been there now? What, 8 years?
8 years, yeah.
Yeah. So can you give us, like, at least in your experience, I don't know if a blueprint would be the word, but at least a sense of given the fact that there are many either nominally or former Christian people who have never experienced liturgical worship or would be suspicious of it. Nevertheless, we would argue need it. How have you gone about, attracting / catechizing those in your church? I'd be interested to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been an interesting ride. I mean, cause I think we've met sort of growing hunger at the same time that we were experiencing it. Other people were experiencing similar things. And I think that is felt most, most profoundly in the lack of all the things we have in the sort of big box church movement, the entertainment over formation kind of model. And so I think people were beginning to see through some of that stuff before we got here. And so we just kind of hit the timing right, I think, to roll that into something that was deeper, that had a stronger mooring and foundations. But yeah, I mean, I think in terms of formation, It's like everyone is unique in their needs, which is wild because we get people who are like on one end of the spectrum have like read every book that exists and have like read their way into Anglicanism, and other people who show up who are like, I don't know what I believe. I was like looking at churches, and it was like either the Church of Latter-day Saints or Hope Anglican Church. And I just came here this week. And so like have utterly nothing. And so I think, yeah, that's been a challenge, because I think that's sort of two like wild ends of a spectrum, but it's everybody's somewhere in the middle. And so figuring out how to speak to both of those groups is super hard. And so what we've done historically has been to just talk to the nerds, and that's great. It's a lot of fun, but it misses people who are on the extreme end of that spectrum, who are just looking to be loved, to enter into something that feels like church, and to grow from that point forward. So I think that's still an open question mark for us, how to really like deeply engage those folks.
Sure.
As you've been doing that engagement work, your story has multiple forks in the road. You can correct me if my math is wrong, but I think before you came to Charleston, there was one Diocese of Christ Our Hope Church in West Virginia, and now I think there are five. Will you tell us a little bit of the story of how that happened?
Absolutely, yeah. That's true. There was one, and I don't know that if that church had not existed, if I would have had the courage to uproot my family and move. To me, it felt like the church there in Parkersburg was in a much harder place than Charleston. So if he could do it, then I could do it too. And so it was like this like incredible gift of like irrational courage given by my brother, Jim, Sally in Parkersburg. But yeah, we moved back and immediately had people coming from like an hour plus away, a couple different communities over an hour away. And so I think we sort of planted pregnant with a church plant. And so, yeah, it was about 2 years in that we really kind of launched into the full kind of gathering planting mode in Beckley, West Virginia.
So when most churches... church plants are barely getting things like a budget together and a leadership team, you guys are starting to think about needing to plant another church in another city.
Yeah. I mean, and this was, I ingrained this in people, I mean, from the very first interest meetings, just kind of going through the math of moderate sized churches, planting moderate sized churches. And I think I based it on like if every 3 years you planted a church that grows to 40 people, and that church plants a church that grows to 40 people, it's like well within like one ministry lifetime that you could reach every person in the state of West Virginia, which is really wild. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, you really like came to Charleston with a vision for the state.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, West Virginia has like less than a million people, right? I mean,
right around a million. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
I mean,
no,
I mean,
numbers
I'm just,
work
I mean,
because it's low. Yeah.
Right. I'm just, yeah. No, I just, I mean, just put it in context. I'm not, that's not a judgment, but it's still a beautiful and breathtakingly audacious sort of vision, which is awesome. And, you know, and I think, you know, you'll probably see some demographic uptick in West Virginia as people realize how beautiful and wide open and relatively low bureaucracy it is compared to some others, we should say.
Don't tell them.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Don't stay. But that's, you know, that's a really a beautiful vision. And, you know, I think, so well, Nick referenced a couple of forks. I mean, obviously that's an initial big fork, is that before you really even settle in, you're already thinking of the next step. And so how have those materialized? I mean, that continues. Yeah, it's a wonderful story.
Each one has been unique. I mean, the first was with kind of initial core group people who were just driving from about an hour away. And so we partnered with a couple of other churches in the diocese to provide clergy for Come and See services. And so we sort of began to gather the group there, and then went about the process of looking for a planter. And so we essentially had a fully formed catechized core team before the planter ever hit the ground. And so that kind of stirred our thinking in terms of how to plant churches in Appalachia, because if that had fallen apart, we risked nothing. I mean, time is all we had spent on that endeavor. And so it's like a really low risk way to go about the work of church planting. And so that factors in largely as we kind of progress down the path. But yeah, we were in at Hope. We had grown to like 60 people. And so we hive off a third of the congregation one Sunday and come back the next week. And it's like, oh, we're like back at square one. Mm-hmm. And so we went about the work of building back up. And we're about 60, a couple years after that.
And it's not fringe people that you're sending out either. These are your core leaders. Yeah.
Yes. That's a man, it hurts to think about it. I miss those people. But yeah, we kind of got back to 60, noticed another pattern of folks who were coming from the other direction, about an hour in the other direction. And we had a priest serving in our church who was working at a classical school in that town. And basically some of the folks down there had an intervention with him and said, we need to go ahead and plant this thing in Huntington. And so we sent out another 25 people west an hour. And it was sort of the same thing. Like we felt like we were hitting critical mass and went back down for the sake of the gospel going forward in new places. And so like the number of people in those places that would drive an hour for church is probably about 20 to 25. And so now both of those churches are far beyond that because we were willing to give away sort of our brightest and best. And so, yeah, that kind of exhausted all the places that we were seeing people come to our church from great distance for. And so, but the first church plant that we did began to see that in their congregation. So they were seeing folks coming from 45 minutes to an hour away and sort of had the same idea. And we're like, well, why don't we just begin to gather folks in that area and then send a church planter. And then, so everything had been kind of normal to this point. And then my first mentor in the Christian faith, who was still in the college town that I went to college in Morgantown, said, what do you think it would look like for us to do something like that in Morgantown, like what you guys have been doing in Morgantown? And I'm like, well, I don't know. We can figure it out. And so we started gathering folks up there. He kind of served initially as the kind of primary gatherer of people. And then we kind of divided duties and went up and offered sort of clergy perspective on things periodically. And then, yeah, kind of as time went on, they discerned that he started the ordination process. They discerned they wanted him to be the planter. And then we kind of brought him on as the planter in Morgantown. Mm.
So has there been a consistent, I don't like to use the word technique, but, you know, given the, as you referenced in the beginning, the challenge of sort of a more unchurched, for lack of a better word, blue collar constituency, or at least demographic, you know, which historically has not proven that difficult exactly for Anglicans, given the fact that it was the established church of the entire English Isles. That being said, we're all very familiar with some of those challenges, at least in theory, in many cases, if not practically. How have you identified that, and, you know, sort of your 8 years of experience working within it? You know, our listener has a very recalcitrant cousin who refuses to skip his golf game on Sunday mornings, and he would like some techniques.
Yeah, for sure.
Asking for a friend. Yeah, that's
Yeah.
funny.
I don't have any techniques for that. I think the only thing that that has proven effective has been prayer. And really leaning deeply into that. I mean, that's been one of the things that I think we've done incredibly well has been really intentionally praying for people who are different from us and for those people we love that are nearby.
And well, when I say techniques, I mean, obviously I've shared with you, there's no magic toolkit that can ensure people come. Nevertheless, you know, the sort of the pedagogy, for lack of a better word, of inviting people in and then catechizing them to the riches of the tradition has challenges no matter what demographic you're dealing with. But I've just been interested in how you face that, you know, with whoever you're dealing with, because it's always edifying to compile our various experiences to that same shared end.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, I think, a like very much something I'm thinking a lot about right now, because I'm not positive that I've done it well yet, but I think that the things that have been most compelling for folks, I think, are, I mean, ironically, there's a whole movement of sort of Bible churches that spend very little time actually reading the scripture publicly, and so I think just pointing out those sorts of things to folks has been really effective in saying, like, well, we may be more of a Bible church than the Bible church you're currently going to, or that you grew up in, that you were mad at, or whatever. And then I think, I mean, just in the context of kind of a crazy world right now, we've been, and I like, it's almost become cringy, but like the being non-anxious in the context of a crazy world has been a compelling vision for folks. I mean, even like walking through the COVID season in a way that that both acknowledged the complexities of what was going on, but at the same time said, like, maybe there are things in our lives that if we lose them, it's worse than dying. And I mean, I would say that church is one of those things. Like, if I would rather, through gathering together with the saints and worshiping, I'd rather die from COVID if that were going to happen than not do that. And so, like, just being very clear in those sorts of things, at the same time not being antagonistic or anxious about them, but saying, like, yeah, I mean, this is very, I don't really know anything about diseases. It turns out they don't teach that in seminary, but what they do teach is that we are eternal, and that we are not, the worst thing that can happen to us in this life has been overcome in Christ Jesus. And so it's this sort of beautiful anti-ideology to everything that's spinning around us, no matter what side of the conversation you find yourself on.
Now we come to the part of the story that inspires jealousy in certain quarters, which is the places that you have come across to worship the Lord. Why don't you tell us how that story has gone for your church?
Yeah. So obviously had no money when we started. I mean, we started from scratch, and we're doing personal fundraising and had a few people kind of faithfully giving. But
and
we're
then every time you started to get to a place where you would get some money, you'd send those people away to another
church.
Exactly.
Yeah. It was not a good strategy. I'm just saying, if you're only looking to build a church, it's a horrible strategy to go about that. But initially we found a Baptist church that was willing to let us meet in the evenings. They were meeting in it was an old flooring warehouse. Like, the garage door for the warehouse was literally right behind the pulpit. So not at all a beautiful space, but the price was right. They said, you don't have to pay us anything. Like, use the space in the evenings. It's awesome. And so we met there for like 8 months, and they were getting ready to move to a different facility, and so we had to be out as well. And so we talked with a bunch of people, a bunch of churches, trying to find some place to rent and meet. And by that point, we had enough that we could pay rent. We weren't like, didn't need to be freeloaders. And so we found this beautiful kind of historic congregation who were, there were like maybe 10 of them left, and they were having a hard time keeping their building open, and were getting ready to kind of just shut things down because of the fact they couldn't, were having a hard time paying their bills. And so we were able to come in kind of pre-year one and offset some of those costs for them, use the space kind of whenever we wanted to. And it was a beautiful relationship. And so we kind of talked with them over time and got closer and closer. And I think it was 4 years into being there, we began to have the conversations with them about what it would look like for us to take kind of primary ownership of the building, to be able to do renovations and invest money into the space, with the understanding that they'd be able to continue to meet there as long as they wanted to, for nothing. And so I think it was the summer of 2024, they signed the building over, and were offended at the idea of us giving them anything for it. They were like, if it's going to be a gift, it's going to be a gift. We're not doing a symbolic $5, $10, whatever the normal legal practice is. No, it's a gift. And so we took ownership of that building in the summer of 2024 and immediately went about the work of renovating. So redid bathrooms, painted the exterior, made sure everything was in working order, did some work in the chancel area. And we're feeling good, but we're looking out at the pews every week, and they were getting more full and more full every week, to the point where we had just begun kind of early 2026 having the conversations about moving to two services, because we're just out of space. There were services where we were pulling out folding chairs to let people kind of sit in the gathering area in the back. And about the same time we were starting to have the two service conversations, a couple from our church reached out and said, hey, we talked to the folks over at St. Paul's Presbyterian, and they are talking about winding down their ministry, and they want to give the building to a biblically faithful kind of reformed church, which we fit that categorically pretty well. Probably the only church that was looking for more meeting space that fit into that category. And so had a few conversations with them. It was a very similar conversation. Like, we don't want anything for it. Like, it will be a gift or it will not happen. To the extent that I think we paid the lawyer more money than what the sort of token exchange would have been to draft a new gift agreement rather than to use this sort of form purchase agreement. But that was what it was. And so they had in 2014 bought this historic Lutheran building, which is where we are now. And they had sold a property where they'd been meeting before to a credit union. It was an old hotel facility that they had been meeting in, and they sold it and then invested almost all of that money into the renovation of this historic building, historic Lutheran church. And so we show up, and like, the walls have been painted, like all of the plaster work had been repaired, the roof had been repaired, the HVAC had all been gone through and repaired, the pews were in great shape, all the woodworking had been, anything that was wrong had been fixed or restored. And so it's like this perfectly pristine, historic, sort of Gothic revival, English parish church looking building.
And it's pretty sizable too, right?
Yeah, it's about double the size of the prayer space. So that immediately relieved our anxiety about moving to two services. And yeah, I mean, I don't know that we could have like sat down and drawn up a more perfect worship space for what we were trying to do. And so, yeah, it's just the unbelievable, unmerited grace of God that we have experienced being poured out on us in both cases. I mean, we have been now given for free and two church buildings, but at the same time, like, I mean, this spirit of like Christian generosity and just like acting like the church, like how the church should act in those sorts of situations is something that's just been an incredible blessing to be able to see that churches acting like churches.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it before. I'd never heard of a church being given a building.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I've heard of churches being turned into restaurants and yoga studios and all sorts of things. So
even mosques.
Imagine. Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's pretty inspiring as you're talking about it for all sorts of reasons, given my current context, particularly the fact that we do have a building that's too small and, you know, also are surrounded by smaller towns with currently empty church buildings. I know they're for sale, but nevertheless, you know, they're not for $10 million. You know, we're talking maybe a couple hundred thousand in certain cases. And, you know, it's just really an inspiring vision. And, you know, there's something to the size church, you know, 40 to 100 or however you want to do it, you know, people who actually live in and around and with each other, and sort of the overlapping relationships there that is, seems to be, you know, I don't know if God's designed a size church, but it seems to be as effective, if not more preferable to something like a 5,000 person church, you know, or some sort of multi-site mega church, particularly given the complexities and the opportunities for growth through weekly, if not daily, personal interaction with sinners in the process of being sanctified, right? And yeah, so, and that's been an interesting new experience for me, because during the summer the students leave, but for the most part the people that are around are people that we see every day in some capacity, and the children growing up together. And it's really been a beautiful experience for my family and sort of changing my ministry even as I speak in terms of teaching and preaching and pastoral care. And that vision, you know, of replanting the Anglican witness in North America has to begin somehow on, you know, every I don't know what you do, 5 square miles or whatever the, you know, whatever the former ideas were.
Hills and hollers is how they say it.
Yeah. Well, that's in West Virginia. I don't know what you're saying in Michigan. I'm sure something with a really long A vowel sound, as far as I can tell, something like Wadder, somewhere near the Wadder. but it's really, Derek, both inspiring and encouraging and sort of real life experience you've had, but also vision for future church plants and church planters. I mean, obviously we can't guarantee you get these free buildings. Although in our diocese, the Reverend Adam Carrington, who came through Hillsdale, was just recently not entirely given a church, but was allowed to, you know, I don't know the exact details. Maybe we should have him on too, but suffice it to say, they now have a beautiful historic former Methodist building that he's now the rector of. And, you know, you hear about these things. And so I think, you know, at the very least, one of the things very practically for a future church planter could be is if you're thinking of a particular city, you might as well find out if there's some, you know, hollowed out church buildings that particularly full of faithful people. You know, I think it happened in Louisville, didn't it? Didn't one of the Baptist churches take over an old sort of flailing? I'm pretty sure that happened, but it's the same situation that, you know, people who oftentimes lament the direction their national or international denomination has gone and nevertheless have remained somewhat faithful. But of course you can only do so much if the brand that you're selling is demonic. And so, so you can't do so. It's like, you know, it's like if you had a really, really good cook in a franchise that everyone else got, E. coli, it's like, I promise we're not one of them. It's like, well, eventually that's going to shut down. And so, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for the people in those denominations. And, you know, I think of my own grandparents who were in St. James Baton Rouge, which I think is still kind of limping along. But I know I spent the last 5 years of my grandmother's life in particular as an ordained, even then an Episcopalian, sort of shielding her from what was actually happening, because in her mind, they still had the 28 prayer book, really. I mean, that was kind of the, but I think that that is a strategic, at least, consideration for future church planners. And the dual use idea, I mean, that's been decades old. I mean, I can remember a friend of mine with a church in Manhattan, that a Baptist church rented in the afternoons, and there was a sort of a kind of a dual use there. And so, I think that the key that you have is both the conviction, and the confidence and the calling, but over top of that, not only a heart for the people to whom you've been called, but also being surrounded by fellow visionaries, because I think that's that, as far as I can tell, some of the church plants that I've never been personally involved in church planting, although I've been around church planters in all the various places I've lived thus far, in certain some capacity, is that you're either too beholden on one person, which can get very complicated very quickly, or there wasn't sufficient sort of prep work done, both personally and then by extension to the place you're going, to endure the challenges that at this point are fairly straightforward and well established. I mean, you're going to have, and so I think, what I hope from your experience, and hopefully this modest podcast would be part of getting the word out, is that, that there are people that have done this before. There are mistakes that have been made. There are, challenges that have been faced. And so, if our listener, which I know they're right on the edge of planting a church, Malibu, I hear Malibu is great this time of, oh wait, this time of every year, right? So, but if that, I hope that you'll be a, I'm sure you'll be a resource, both, sort of as an idea, but also, I mean, you're not hard to get in touch with, but it's my hope that, if 20 years from now we look back and that this is not a one-off or a unique situation, but there's places all over the country. I'm from Baton Rouge, and I think there's one church in Baton Rouge. But the whole state of Louisiana has something like four or five, and I mean that's a big state. We've got, Alabama, we've got Arkansas, we've got, I mean, again, I'm just thinking of the South where I'm from, but Michigan for that matter. I don't know how many churches we actually have, but you've redoubled my interest in considering these empty buildings around us and saying, what is that going to look like? So I'm very encouraged by it and grateful for your commitment, and also just look forward to seeing how this, how many years did you say it would take before West Virginia becomes, the
100% Anglican.
Anglican theocracy? They're like,
I think
when the lines are drawn again, it'll
yeah,
be
if memory serves, it was about 40 years.
okay.
I
Well.
think we've gotten off the off that trajectory a bit, but
Well.
we're holding
Well,
out hope.
give or take in the life of the church, give or take, a couple of hundred years,
Yeah,
you can
right,
see
yeah.
quite some change. So.
Actually, you're not the only church in West Virginia that has had this kifting of a church happen, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, maybe the only one who's
Gotten
had
two.
a pure gift and two pure gifts, but I think we have it's three other churches this year, I think, that have gotten buildings, and I think the most that any of them paid was around $40,000, which is wild. I mean, that's essentially a gift in the context of buying property. And yeah, it's just been really cool to see. And it's been very similar in that there's been a relational connection with the people of the church that has borne fruit in giving or essentially giving away property.
So you're saying I can hold out hope.
Become friends with a lot of
Yeah,
people, and
well, you've
maybe
lost
those will
him.
bear
You've lost him already.
fruit.
Sorry. So what's the other way to do
Yeah, I don't know.
it?
I don't know.
Because bribery sort of defeats the purpose, right?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Well, we're so glad that you were willing to share your story with us. It is a great encouragement. You're the closest church geographically to me in our diocese. I think you're 2.5 hours away. So maybe when we next have you on, there'll be more churches in between us. How about that?
Amen. Let's do
Amen.
It.
Amen. I love it.
Well, that's going to be all the time that we have for our show today. Thanks for listening to Stand Firm this week. If you want to keep the conversation going, be in touch with us, rate and review the podcast on iTunes, send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com, or you can join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to J.D. Koch, and a special thank you to Derek Roberts. I'm Nick Landon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.